August 12, 2022, a sunny morning in upstate New York. An author walks onto a stage, and within seconds, his life explodes into violence. Salman Rushdie, one of the world's most celebrated writers, was stabbed repeatedly by a 24-year-old man who'd been inspired by a tweet announcing his appearance. The attack came 34 years after Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini issued a death sentence over Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses. The knife blinded one eye, crippled one hand, and thrust Rushdie back into a nightmare he'd spent decades escaping. But this isn't just a story about violence. It's about what happens when you refuse to let brutality write your ending. What strikes you first about Rushdie's account isn't the horror, though there's plenty. It's the absurd, almost mundane details that accompany near death. A retired fireman pressing on his neck wound keeps introducing himself to everyone. Doctors ask his weight for the helicopter transport, and even bleeding out, Rushdie feels embarrassed admitting 240. Your body surrenders its privacy so you won't die. Strangers prod, drain, inject, stitch your exposed form. The yellow and black helicopter lands so gently he doesn't realize they've touched ground. Then people running, an anesthetic mask, and after that, nothing. 4 days vanish entirely. What haunts Rushdie most isn't the physical damage, it's the narrative theft. For 3 decades, he'd fought to be seen simply as a writer, not the fatwa victim. He'd nearly succeeded, until the knife dragged him back to an identity he'd spent half his life refusing. The attacker claimed to admire Ayatollah Khomeini while admitting he'd read only a couple pages of Rushdie's work. 4 years in his mother's basement, consuming content from what Rushdie calls Imam YouTube, transformed a young man into someone who believed murder was righteous. His worldview divided humanity into 2 billion us versus 6 billion them, with no room for nuance or doubt. When Rushdie imagines confronting him, he realizes their fundamental divide. You could try to kill because you didn't know how to laugh. Violence becomes possible when you lose the capacity to see complexity, to question certainty, to recognize shared humanity. The knife wasn't just aimed at one man, it was aimed at the very idea that stories can contain multitudes. While Rushdie fought for survival in surgery, his family's world shattered across continents. His wife, Eliza, endured an eternity of conflicting rumors. He's dead, he's fine, he's been stabbed multiple times. Someone told her to hurry because he wasn't going to make it. In London, his son Zafar, who'd grown up under the fatwa shadow and lost his mother to cancer at 19, cried through the night, certain his father wouldn't survive until morning. His other son, Milan, who hadn't flown in 6 years due to acute fear, booked passage on the Queen Mary 2 to reach him. Violence detonates in one place and sends shrapnel everywhere. Eliza was jostled by paparazzi on the day of the attack, then stalked by photographers for weeks. Rushdie's sister, Samin, flew from London to massage his feet as they used to do for their mother, speaking Urdu together. These small acts, foot massages, bedside vigils, impossible journeys undertaken despite terror, became the counterweight to hatred. When hundreds gathered at the New York Public Library in solidarity, hearing Je suis Salman moved Rushdie deeply. Similar gatherings happened worldwide. He felt, he says, the healing power of love from strangers, family, and friends. Recovery begins with sitting in a chair, then shuffling halfway down a corridor with a walking frame. Each small victory lifts his spirits, though medical realities persist: fluid bags, a damaged saliva channel, an immobilized left hand. His blinded right eye and crippled hand are constant reminders of his new reality. The hand becomes his obsession. Despite his surgeon's pessimism, Rushdie commits to proving him wrong through painful therapy sessions. Progress comes incrementally, touching fingertips to palm, curling fingers inward, reaching his thumb to his little finger, a journey that initially feels like crossing interstellar space. By March 2023, 7 months post-attack, his surgeon declares the recovery miraculous. His left fist nearly matches his right. Fingers move independently. Strength returns. Throughout recovery, Rushdie rarely feels anger. It seems wasteful. He focuses on survival and reclaiming his carefully built free life. Each milestone, using the toilet independently, walking unassisted, returning to New York, feels liberating. Seeing Manhattan again lifts his spirits. It's Jolie's laid streets, both generous and mean. It's talent and rats. It's everything at onceness. As a lifelong city dweller, he's back in his preferred ocean, this story sea of concrete and steel. After surviving, Rushdie contemplates his second chance, centering it on love and work, the twin pillars of a meaningful life. But the digital world intrudes immediately. Encountering virulent Twitter messages comparing him to the Dajjal, the one-eyed false messiah in Muslim demonology, he leaves the platform entirely. This crystallizes his conviction. His new chapter must include actively combating false narratives and bigoted revisionism, not retreating into private life. At the Penn Gala, receiving the Centenary Courage Award, he delivers a defiant message: terror must not terrorize us. As spring transitions to summer, his anger gradually dissipates. 1 year after the attack, he identifies three healing elements: time's passage, therapy's benefits, and the cathartic process of writing this book. 13 months later, he returns to Chautauqua with Eliza, hoping this pilgrimage will help him leave that terrible day behind. Standing where he'd fallen, he feels not weakness, but strength, not trauma, but transformation. The space that once held terror now feels reclaimed. "We're done here," he tells Eliza. "Let's go home." For 3 months after the attack, writing felt impossible. When Rushdie examined notes for his next novel, it seemed absurd. His agent had been right. Until he confronted the attack directly, he couldn't write anything else. He needed to own what happened, refuse victimhood, and answer violence with art. When Eliza showed him recovery footage, the images shocked him. His bulging eye at an impossible angle, the gash in his blackened neck, the stab wounds. He hadn't realized how terrible he looked. His family must have been terrified while offering daily optimistic lies. He wasn't doing well. He was someone on the very point of death who had somehow remained alive. The most upsetting aspect? How the attack transformed him back into someone he'd spent decades trying not to be. "I'll never be able to escape it," he admitted. "I'll always be the guy who got knifed. The knife defines me." Living was his victory, but the meaning the knife gave his life was his defeat. Yet in writing this account, Rushdie reclaims his narrative. The knife, meant to silence him, gave him a new voice, one speaking of resilience, love, and art's enduring power. In a world where stories are weaponized and certainty becomes deadly, we need voices insisting on complexity and shared humanity. The knife may have marked Rushdie, but his words will endure. This is the ultimate defiance, transforming destruction into an affirmation of life and creativity.